Okay, so hello everyone, and welcome to the War and Representation podcast series. My name is Anders Engberg Petersen. I am a professor of literature and culture at the University of Southern Denmark, and I currently run the research project, The Aesthetics of Late Modern War. Now, I'm joined today by Neil Santillanes, who's a professor of Spanish at St. Louis University. Now, this is a very virtual setup, COVID-19 style, I suppose, because Neil is in Barcelona and I am in Copenhagen. But this is the way things run at the moment. But Neil, it's great having you here. So thank you very much for taking the time to discuss your work with me today.
Well, thanks to you, Anders, for inviting me. It's a pleasure being here with you.
Absolutely. Now, Neil, he has written quite extensively on warfare and on fascism as well. He's written on Goya and Clausewitz. A few years ago, he published the book Wittgenstein's Ethics and Modern Warfare, and then fairly recently, he published the book that we will discuss today. It's called The Literature of Absolute War: Transnationalism and World War II. And it appeared with Cambridge University Press earlier this year. Now, I happen to be one of the reviewers of this book, and it was just a tremendous pleasure reading the manuscript and now seeing the book in print. It's a very, I think, both unusual and very impressive study because it's very large in scope. It's comparative, it's transnational in its approach. It covers quite a range of literatures, so there are readings of French, Italian, British, German, Russian, and I think also even Japanese works of literature, among others. So it's a book that sort of stands out from the more specialized studies of warfare and literature. So Neil, I'm a bit curious. Might you tell us a bit about what led you to this particular topic of absolute war and the literature of World War II, and also about this approach that you decided, this transnational approach that you decided to take?
Yes, of course. It is a good question. My interest in absolute war goes back to 2008, 2009, when I was invited to give a lecture on Goya, it was the bicentennial of what in Spain they call the War of Independence, the Peninsular War, when it started in 1808. And I thought, well, I was interested. I was reading Clausewitz at the time. I was getting interested in war studies, and I decided to give a lecture on Goya Clausewitz. And I was approached by a publisher, and he suggested to turn that lecture into a long essay, and that's what I did, and that's how it started, my interest in absolute war. Then it didn't stop there. I was it knocked me that the notion of absolute war, and I thought, well, I have to do something about it. But then I started the project on fascism, and I put it aside. I kept reading on war. Particularly, I was interested, since my background is in literary studies, I began reading extensively on war, war literature. That's what I read, especially fiction, but not only fiction. When I finished my project on fascism, I decided to work on it professionally, if you will, systematically. And my initial intention was to write on the two world wars. I wanted to write an unpublishable book on the two world wars. I realized that when I had several chapters written, that nobody would publish such a long book, because I envisioned a two-book volume. And then I put that aside, and I wrote a long essay on Wittgenstein's Ethics and the Great War. So I took advantage of the material I had already done research about, and I wrote the essay that you mentioned. It's a very short book. And after finishing that, I decided to revisit my interest in absolute war, and but apply it to a specific war. And I decided World War II, because although World War I was definitely a total war, but I have my reservations as regards the dimension of absolute war in the Great War. There were
Right.
instances of absolute war, but in my opinion, they were minor.
But
That is not the case. That is not the minor in the sense that they were concentrated, that they were focused in specific battlefields, and I didn't see the absolute animosity among contendants that there was in the Second World War, particularly in two fronts, the Eastern Front, the war between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, which was particularly vicious. There is a very interesting book by Chris Bellamy, Absolute War, that's the title, which describes that war as an overlapping of absolute and total war. That was
Might
very important for my research, that
Neil,
book.
might you sort of help us out here, because I think there are two terms that are often confused in scholarship, and you make quite an effort to separate them. So one is absolute war, and another is total war. How are they distinguished, and how do they overlap?
Well, absolute war is a philosophical term that was coined by Clausewitz in his treatise on war. It refers to war in itself. Absolute in philosophy means independent and unconditioned reality. And that's what Clausewitz intended to say when he described absolute war. That is, he considered that war was an unconditioned and independent reality. The true nature of warfare is absolute war, sort of essence. He thought in the terms of Hegelian philosophy, and absolute war is something similar to absolute spirit, is something that has always been there. But not quite, and it has evolved until it has become itself in reality, according to Clausewitz, wrongly, in my belief, in the Napoleonic campaigns, when Napoleon didn't stop until he destroyed the enemy. There were no political considerations because, according to Clausewitz, absolute war is a theoretical notion. It's that is hindered most of the time by policy. We all know, no, Clausewitz's famous dictum, according to which war is the continuation of policy, not politics, policy, Staatspolitik, by other means. And that's what halts the enormous destructive power. That is at the core of the nature of war, that is absolute war. Clausewitz believed his book, he didn't finish the book, so there are some inconsistencies. Sometimes Clausewitz says that war came close to its absolute with Napoleon. Hat sich sehr genähert, has approached itself. And in other occasions, on another occasion, I think it's in book two of On War, he says, Erreichte has reached its absolute power with Napoleon. So the fact is that we don't know really. It's impossible to tell whether Clausewitz thought that w this kind of w this 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 theoretical notion had become reality or not. With Napoleon.
Right, because I remember also how he sort of vacillates between the two, saying that on the one hand it's approached absolute warfare for the first time in history, and then there's another passage where he says that finally war marched forth and threw off its fetters and marched forth in its raw violence. So I entirely agree that, there is that sort of vacillation. But then what you do is to bring that concept to bear on a very different period, namely World War II.
Yes. Yes, because given that it's a philosophical notion, I think it can be applied beyond the time in which it was coined, in the 1820s, when he wrote on war. It's transtemporal, transhistorical, like other notions, like realism, no, in literature that was used at the end of the 18th century by the Schlegels, and now we use it. We still use the notion of realism, the same with the notion of modernism. And in my case, what I do is I apply it to the Second World War, and I use it as if the situation it had been reached, conditions of absolute war, I mean, that they had reached absolute war in the Pacific, in the war between Japan and the United States and on the Eastern Front. It's never in, it happens like in literature, when you talk about the modernist work, that it's approximative, no? The work never comprehends all the family resemblances, to use the notion coined by Wittgenstein, of modernism, and that the same happens with absolute war. It's an impossibility that a specific war, which can be described as absolute, meets all the criteria for being absolute. That there are elements that hinder that absolute war to reach the purity, like with modernist works or realist works, no?
And what would the key criteria be in the works that you examined in World War II?
I think there are some criteria to describe, it's not science, no, but there are some criteria that can help us reach the conclusion that specific real war, as Clausewitz would say, real war, Wirklichkeit, are met, for instance, the performance of what he would say unbracketed, unrestrained, extreme violence. That would be one. Another feature would be a notion coined by Carl Schmitt that I use with Clausewitz's notion of absolute war, which is absolute enmity. Mm-hmm. The absolute enemy is that that enemy that must be destroyed at all costs, a less than human individual, unreasonable, that must be exterminated. That's another feature. The drive to exterminate the opponent or force him to an unconditional surrender, which is the first happened in the war between Russia, the Soviet Union and Germany, in which the only consideration that was on the table was the extermination of the other, and unconditional surrender, as you know, is the condition that put the United States on the table for Japan to surrender. Japan wanted to surrender, but not unconditionally, but the States wanted Japan to surrender unconditionally. That would be another criteria. Another feature would be the almost complete predominance of military criteria. So if absolute war was pure, it would be the total predominance, but there are always some political criteria that lead military actions, even if military criteria are predominant over political considerations. Another would be the merciless struggle for life or death, that comes directly from Clausewitz, and the view of enemy civilians as a legitimate target. These are some features that when combined, because they need to be combined one one I don't think would be enough to call a war absolute war. One would need four or five criteria taking place at the same time to reach the conclusion that a specific war meets the criteria for absolute war. This would be some of the features.
Right. So I remember there was a book by David Bell a couple of years ago on the first total war, which was about the Napoleonic Wars. And that term, total warfare, which you know in that book is spoken of with regards to the same period in which absolute war, the term is coined, is something rather different from the philosophical concept of absolute war. So can you tell us a bit about how is total war different from the philosophical concept of absolute war?
Yes, absolute war is a philosophical concept. Total war is not. I wouldn't say it's a journalistic concept, but it appeared to explain something new, at least in Europe, because in the States there was a total war in the middle of the war. The Civil War was a total war, or very it came close to being a total war. But the first mention to total war came in a speech delivered by Clemenceau, the French Senate, in 1917. And 1 year later, Léon Daudet, the noted novelist and journalist, wrote a book, La Guerre Totale, Total War, to describe what still was going on, because he published it in 1918, but before the end of the war. And he claimed that the Great War, as it was known then, consisted of the extension of warfare to areas that have been exempted from war, economics less, no? But cultural life, banking, the financial system, everything he claimed was involved in total war. Then years later, Erich Ludendorff, the former German general, the one put together with Hindenburg, had total control of war operations in Germany. He wrote Der totale Krieg, the total war, in 1935. And he, according to Ludendorff, the novelty of the Great War was that the people fought for its, I think he calls it Lebenserhaltung, the survival of the people, no? And so the involvement of the German people in the war was what made it total. So, a few years earlier in 1930, Ernst Jünger published his essay, Total Mobilization. So these three essays, Léon Daudet, Ludendorff's, and Jünger's, established a very clear to me notion of total war, one in which what matters is the extension of warfare to all levels of society, total mobilization. That seems to be the kernel of total war before the essays published before the Second World War. Now, what happened is that after the Second World War, there appeared certain books that canonized a different use of the notion of total war. I am thinking particularly in a book by Raymond Aron, The Century of Total War, which was published, I believe, in the mid-1950s, I think 54, but I'm not sure. And 10 years later, at the end of the 1960s, Gordon Wright published The Ordeal of Total War. The first book, the one by Aron, was on the first on the two wars, and the book by Gordon Wright was about World War II. These two books initiated were the first to use total war in the with the as the notion that we know today, that is, total war is indeed the extension of warfare to all strata of society, but it includes also what Clausewitz understood by absolute war, the intensity of war, the extreme levels of violence, the consideration of the enemy as an absolute enemy, the drive to exterminate the opponent, the viability, the lifting of all moral concerns regarding the bombing of civilians living in their cities. And the book by David Bell, strangely, instead of using the notion by Clausewitz, absolute war, he uses total war as it is commonly used today and extrapolates it to a situation mm-hmm. in which total war didn't exist. The book is very interesting, but I think that it would have been better if he had used the notion by Clausewitz, because it would have been more pertinent.
Yes, I suppose he does sort of the opposite of what you do, where you use his philosophical concept of absolute war and apply it to World War II, and he uses a much more modern conception of total war and then applies it back into the Napoleonic Wars.
Yes, and that made it controversial. I remember the reviews written on that book were mixed, no, because some people thought it was anachronistic to call that war total war. And the problem with the notion of total war, it is of course useful, but when you write the history of warfare, for instance, I remember, I don't have it with me, I have it in my flat in St. Louis, the fourth volume of the Cambridge History of War, which is fantastic, and there is a section, I believe, which is called the era of post-total war, that is after the Second World War. So after, of course, it's very difficult to find now wars that meet the criteria of total war. And then you go to Korea or you go to Vietnam, and what you see is not exactly total war, because there was no mobilization of the entire society, although the Vietnam War mobilized society in a different way, but not in support of the war effort, but contrary to the war effort. But that's a different story. So I think that if you use total war simply as it was used before World War II, by Ludendorff and by Daudet, by Junger, and you modernize the theoretical component, so that the description, instead of using the words that you use, you improve them, and if you keep it as that, as the mobilization of society, then you use absolute war to refer to what I said earlier. Mm-hmm. You would have a different panorama. That is, you would have a panorama in which, yes, there is 1945, there haven't been total wars, but there have been wars in which the enemy has been seen as an absolute enemy, and in which there has been a drive to exterminate the opponent, in which there has been unbracketed, unrestrained extreme violence, and so on and so forth, like the Vietnam War. So it would be possible to talk about the end of total war or the era of total warfare. But at the same time, if you take out from the notion of total war as it is used today, the intensity, and you recover the notion of Clausewitz, it would be possible to talk, okay, the Vietnam War is not an absolute, it's not a total war, but it came very close to being an absolute war. Mm-hmm. I think it would refine our tools for writing the history of warfare if we started to talk about total war and absolute war instead of simply total war.
Right, right.
Now and, encompasses what Clausewitz understood by absolute war.
Now you do that in your book, make this separation, and I guess right now we've been talking a lot about different terms with which to speak about a war, and also just the history of warfare. But your book is really about the literature of absolute war, and I think the problem of literary representation. So I would like to ask you, because war often comes across as a kind of test case for writing as such, and for literature. There's something about war, its complexity, its intensity, and so on, that seems to thwart the standard means of representation. It actually leads to creativity, but it also leads to just a reconsideration of how literature even is able to represent a phenomenon such as war. But it also seems to do so in very different ways. So in some of my earlier work, I was looking at the Napoleonic Wars that were highly complex. And this was in part due to their enormous extension and the vastness of war that suddenly authors had to 19th century authors had to grapple with. You know, how do you actually represent something as complex as a Napoleonic battle? And that proved very, very difficult. But in your book, you talk about absolute warfare in World War II, and it seems to be much more a matter of intention and ferocity that seems to sort of require new literary forms. Can you tell us a bit about when you sort of look across this panorama that you give of the literature of World War II, what are some of the problems that emerge when literary works seek to deal with and represent this ferocity, this intensity of absolute war?
Yes, indeed. It's the absolute war poses warfare in general poses challenges to literary representation, not only absolute war, I would say, but war in general. It's a challenge to representation. The fact is that authors have answered to this challenge in very different ways. In the absolute war fought, because I focused especially on two fronts, the Eastern Front, which is the first chapter, which I titled The Horror, and the attack on civilians, the second chapter, Terror, which delves into the representation of aerial bombing, strategic bombing, and atomic bombing. And then the third chapter is the return of the soldier, homecoming specters. But in the second chapter, I saw something that I found striking when I did research. When I compared the representation of the aerial bombing of the UK, especially London, but not only London, but especially London, and then the representation of the aerial bombing of Germany. So in the case of the UK, it seemed that the bombing didn't challenge the representation of the bombing. So there are many instances of realist works, and there are few instances of experimental works. In the UK, about 60,000 people died as a result of the bombing. It was terrible, but it wasn't as terrible as the bombing inflicted on Germany. The figures there vary. According to some, 400,000 people died. British historians claim that it was much less, 250,000. But regardless of these figures, the truth is that the bombing on Germany was much more severe than the bombing of the UK. So in the and in Germany, there has been a literature on aerial bombing in which there is a destruction of form. I'm thinking of novels like Retribution by Gerd Leirich, or there is another one, Walter Kempowski, the Rote Hahn, the Red Rooster, and there are other works which are openly experimental, as if there were a correlation between the level of violence and the level of violence inflicted on form, whereas that didn't happen. That didn't happen as in the United Kingdom, in Great Britain, and I think because of the severity of the bombing, it wasn't as severe as the bombing of Germany. There are experimental works. There are modernist works. I'm thinking of Elizabeth Bowen, the Heat of the Day, for instance, or Henry Green's Caught, which are on bombing, but they are not as extreme as other works, as works published in Germany. So I think that there is a correlation between the extremity of violence and the experimentation on form, as if the form determined, as if violence determined the choices made by the authors. I cannot say that there isn't realist literature on an absolute war, because that wouldn't be true. But there is an abundance of modernist works. I've seen more modernist works than realist works in the corpus of literature that I have explored apropos of the Second World War. And that happens also with the works written by Hibakusha, the Japanese term to refer to survivors of the atomic bomb. They are experimental. There are embedded narratives. There are experiments with language. It's really fascinating to see how the Japanese had to grapple with the representation of bombing. There are several narrators, but that happens also in John Hersey's book, Hiroshima, which is narrated by six or seven focal, there are narrators and focalizers in that chronicle. So yes, there is an homology between absolute war and certain types of literary practices, for instance, what I call catastrophic modernism.
Right. This sort of homology and experimentation that takes place as a response to the intensity of the experience of absolute warfare, would that somehow make the literature of World War II the sort of ne plus ultra of literary representation, in the sense that here literature reaches perhaps one of its limits? And I'm thinking, because of having read your book, I'm thinking also of how this literature measures up to more recent literature of contemporary warfare, with, you know, the modern type of distant hybrid wars that seem to have endlessness as a key feature. Their low intensity, not the ferocity that we read about from the Second World War. So what is sort of the status, would you say, of this literature of absolute war? Is it somehow representative of warfare, war writing in general, or is it sort of, has it reached the extreme of literary representation?
Well, it's difficult to talk about extremes. At least it's difficult for me. I wouldn't say that the literature of on absolute war is the non plus ultra in this case of, let's say, modernism, for instance, because there are radical instances of modernism that haven't been met by works on absolute war. I'm thinking of Finnegan's Wake, for instance, or other works or other modernist works that have nothing to do with war and are extremely radical. For me, modernism is a long durée literary practice that starts with Don Quixote and continues to the present. It is indeed a movement, it's a movement that took place in a specific period in history, but it's also a literary practice that has been available for authors for centuries, since the 17th century. And Tristram Shandy is a very radical modernist work that has nothing to do with warfare. But it is true at the same time that the notion of modernism was not sufficient for me to explain certain features that I detected in modernist works devoted to absolute war. I mean, absolute war as practiced in World War II. These were works that contained the typical family resemblances of modernism, but at the same time added shared these works certain features that I didn't see as often in modernist works, and that is that I saw, for instance, that these texts are determined to a certain extent by disaster. That is, that disaster or catastrophe, war in this case, led authors to seek those literary techniques that were more cogent for representing war. I saw also that these modernist texts subverted more conventional ways used to communicate warfare. I saw also an ethical dimension that is not necessarily present in all modernist works, but they are, this dimension is present in this kind of modernism. And these modernist works also constituted what the American philosopher Stanley Cavell called passionate utterances. Passionate utterance is a term defined by Cavell as a perlocutionary speech act produced to have consequential effects on the reader's feelings, affects, emotions, that is to condition him, no? And I also saw a fifth feature, which was what I call the writing of cruelty. That is, by writing of cruelty, I understand the kind of writing that creates uneasiness in the reader, so as to convey the violence of absolute war. Some authors perform violence on language to communicate the physical violence in the battlefield, and this is very unpleasant to read, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
These features led me. I thought, well, the notion of modernism is useful, but I should do something about it. I see a subcategory of modernism, and I decided to call that subcategory catastrophic modernism. I got inspired by the writing of Disaster, written by Maurice Blanchot, and also it encouraged me. Michael Rothberg has that book on traumatic realism. He thought that the notion of realism didn't really apply adequately, wasn't enough to explain the realist literature produced in the Holocaust. Well, the same happened to me with modernism referred to World War II. And I coined this notion of catastrophic modernism because I found it useful. I wouldn't say that this is the limit of modernism, but I would say that in the same way that for Clausewitz, absolute war is the kernel of any war, I couldn't help but see in the literature written, and this is my answer to your second question, I couldn't help but see in the literature of the Second World War the kernel of any kind of war writing, because everything is there. You see all sorts of literature produced on World War II, and the literature written on Iraq, for instance, Phil Clay, and other authors who have written on the Iraq War, draw from that literature. Really,
mm-hmm.
The levels of violence are not as extreme as World War II, but I see a tradition that in fact starts with World War I, not World War II. Catastrophic modernism is a phenomenon that can be seen also in World War I, in the literature written by some authors. World War II took that literature to extremes, that's true. And this tradition of the two world wars is the kernel of the literature written later on more limited wars.
So this, if you will allow me one more question, this sort of continued presence of war is also the topic of your last your third long chapter on specters, where you talk about the sort of eerie hauntology of war. Wars don't seem to really end, or at least their ending is a very long process. It most often sort of the cultural process really only begins once the wars are over. And there's a sense in which also reading these you know, fascinating but also in many ways dreadful literary works, there's a sense of bringing back to life the horrors and the terrors of absolute warfare. And I'm wondering whether you could say a bit about what the role of literature is in this process, in sort of both continuing the wars, making them available for us today, memorializing them, and at the same time trying to get some kind of handle on them. What would you say is the role of literature in this process?
There is a movie, Hiroshima Mon Amour, mm-hmm. In the first scene of the movie, which is a very long one, it's 16 minutes, there are two characters laying on bed, they are unnamed. She's an actress, French actress, shooting a film on location in Hiroshima, and she's with her lover, who is an architect born in Hiroshima and living there. The movie was shot, I think, in 1954, if I recall correctly. So the movie is the action of the movie takes place a few years after the bombing of Hiroshima, and she tells him what she has seen in Hiroshima and documentaries she has seen, and remains of hair, things she has seen in the museum. And he keeps telling her that you have seen nothing, you have seen nothing, you have understood nothing. So there are two things here. One is that she cannot understand, according to the Japanese character, what happened in Hiroshima, because she wasn't there, and nobody can understand the full force of an atomic weapon unless he has survived. But on the other hand, we are the French actress. That is, what we have in front of us are the remains of war. And the war are not only what's left, buildings or corpses that are buried. They are also memories. Memories are remains of war. The survivors are remains of war. And literature written to on war are also remains on war. Remains on war that have the capacity to reach the future. That's what I need to recall that notion, Strahlungen, no, by Ernst Jünger, mm-hmm. radiations. His war journal, Ernst Jünger wrote a war journal
right.
during the war and on its wake, that he titled Radiations. And a work of literature radiates to the future, has the capacity to affect us. And that is even truer of wars of fiction or literature, written literature on warfare, that and it can have an effect on us, because unlike other works of literature that are meant to entertain or think, but not necessarily not on war. Works on war force on us an ethical reflection on warfare, a historical reflection on warfare, and sometimes even an emotional reflection on warfare. I didn't live. I wasn't even born. The Spanish Civil War, which didn't affect my family in a very negative way. And even so, when I read works on the Spanish Civil War, they have an effect on me. They radiate their force to me. And they force on me a reflection at once ethical and personal. And the same happens with works on World War II, that stay with us and have this effect. No, that's why I call them remains of war, because they have an effect.
And I would say that the same actually applies to the sort of scholarly work like this book seeks to understand then this literature and how it deals with absolute warfare. If you know, we read all sorts of scholarly texts, but I think there are texts on warfare that also have this capacity to somehow channel both the ethical reflections and the historical reflections that literature you know, cast upon us. So it becomes a kind of conduit also for forcing one to reflect more seriously on the events of the past, and I think your book does that eminently well. So perhaps this is a good way to end. But I want to thank you so much for your time and for discussing this book. This was Neil Santillanes speaking about his new book, The Literature of Absolute War, from Cambridge University Press, 2020. You should all go read it. Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you.